If you have your Bibles, let's open up to Hebrews chapter 11. Hebrews chapter 11. So we have been in a series on the book of Hebrews and taking a look at what the author of Hebrews talks about, which is this idea that Jesus is greater. He's greater than what has come before. So the author of Hebrews, in a particularly Jewish context, is looking around and asking the question, you know, what do we do now that Jesus has come? What does it mean to be the people of God? And what do we do with the traditions of old? And what do we do with now that Jesus has come, God's Son has come, that God's Son has revealed who God is, and that the ultimate revelation of who God is, though we've heard about it in the past, what do we do now that we know what God is like because he has sent his Son? And so this idea that Jesus is greater than, he's greater than angels who have come down to explain who God is. Jesus does that better. They are servants. He is a son. Moses, greater than Moses also. Moses is a servant. Jesus is a son. Greater than Aaron, who's a high priest. All the previous high priests were able to cover sins, but Jesus as a high priest is able to take away sins. He's great. He's a better sacrifice. So the whole theme of the book of Hebrews is that Jesus is greater. And the author of Hebrews comes to chapter 11 and now wants to talk about this thing that Jesus modeled for all of us. He is the ultimate experience of faith, that Jesus has modeled as an example of faith and has shown an experience of faith. But Jesus is not the first to show an experience of faith, but he does show the greatest experience of faith, which is this idea of trust in the face of invisibility, that God and his promises are oftentimes invisible to us. They've come from the past. God has promised and they are sure, but the idea is that we don't always see them. It is not always with great clarity that we walk in trust, right? That faith is trust in the face of a God who can at times be invisible and hard to find, and trust in the face of invisibility of his promises that are not always realized in our life or in our lifetime. Hebrews 12 says faith, or 11 says faith is the reality of the things you hope for and the evidence of the things you cannot see. And this faith is when God and his promises are invisible, how we respond to that in trust and obedience and worship, that is what faith is. Let me say that again, okay? Because sometimes we wonder, faith, what is faith? What does it mean to have faith? When God and his promises are invisible and they're difficult to discern and to see, how we respond to that in trust and worship and obedience, that is what faith is. So the author of Hebrews here in chapter 11 is walking through what experiences of faith have looked like for the faithful through the past and through the generations. And today, we have an example of faith in the passage that Ryan read for us. We have an example of faith being passed down from generation to generation. As a matter of fact, it's the first four generations of God's covenant promise to Abraham, to the people of God, those first four generations, what that looks like, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. And what I want to do this morning is simply not cramp up. I'm just kidding. Okay, that's back to goal one, right? Not pull a hammy on this one. I was joking with Ryan that if you see me like while I'm preaching to this, you know, you'll know that it's just tightness. Okay, but all that to say, what I want to do is I want to just remind us of these stories, but I also want us to just ask the question, like, if I were to give like a one-line description of a profound experience of faith in my life, what might I say about that? And what would we say about these four folks? And just to reflect, as God is at work in my life, it might not look like everybody else's experience of faith, but nonetheless, we all are in the process of trusting and worshiping in the face of invisibility when we cannot see as clearly as maybe we hope for. And how might I characterize that in my own life and even celebrate what God is doing in the lives of the people here. All right, so let's take a look. So our first, turn to verse 17, 11, 17. We'll start with Abraham, and we'll read these. We'll read a little bit about this, and then we'll ask the question, what does this mean for Abraham? And I do have some fill-in-the-blanks. I know some of you guys love the fill-in-the-blanks. Some of you guys are like, look, I didn't come here to work, Pastor Craig. But just trust me. Anyway, there you go. Hebrews 11, 17. It says, by faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered Isaac, and he who had received the promises was in the act of offering up his only son, of whom it was said, through Isaac shall your offspring be named. Now, the story of the original promises and covenant of God with Abraham is told in the book of Genesis, the first book of your Bible, Genesis chapter 12, chapter 15, and chapter 17. And one of the promises for Abraham was the promise that God would make him into a great nation. And what that meant was that there would be, the promise was, the number of your descendants will be like the innumerable sand on the seashore. Or look at the stars in the sky. That's what your descendants is. You're going to have an uncountable amount of descendants. And the original promises is that he's going to have a lot. He's going to have a great nation. But Abraham and Sarah, in their lifetime, would not have innumerable children. I suppose Sarah is like, look, I want a big family, but that would be a lot, right? All right, you moms out. Mother's Day, that's not the Mother's Day sermon. Okay. But in their lifetime, they have one son, Isaac. And in Genesis 22, God says this. After these things, God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham. And Abraham said, here I am. Genesis 22:2 says, and he said, take your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall tell you. And Hebrews says that this is a test. So Abraham goes and he takes Isaac and they walk up to Mount Moriah with wood and fire and a knife, but no lamb for the burnt offering. And when Isaac, he's like a 13-year-old kid at this time, when Isaac notices this, he's like, hey, Dad, I see the fire and the knife and the wood, but where's the lamb? And then Abraham says, look, God will provide the offering. Where is the lamb? And so Abraham takes Isaac, and they go up on top, and he begins to tie Isaac up on the altar. And when Isaac notices, and this must have been an act of faith on Isaac's part. It's probably one of his acts of faith. But Abraham is tying up Isaac on the altar, and as he's about to use the knife on Isaac, an angel of the Lord steps in and stops Abraham. And there's a sheep that's caught in the thicket off to the side. And this is where Abraham names the place Jehovah Jireh, Yahweh Yireh, which is my provider. Jireh, my provider, that God has stayed the hand. And that though he was willing to offer his own son, God says, no, you don't have to do that. I will provide a substitute. And of course, there's a lot of imagery in there as you think about Isaac carrying the wood up the hill, that Jesus then becomes the ultimate example of the provision of God. But that's a whole nother sermon. We don't have time for that. But the Lord is my provider. And the idea is that why would Abraham even consider taking a knife and killing his own son, or being ready to kill his own son? Why would he be willing and able to do that? And Hebrews gives us a little bit of a window into the mind of Abraham. Look at verse 19. Why would he be willing to offer up his own son? In verse 19, it says, he considered that God was able even to raise him from the dead. And it goes on to say, which figuratively speaking, he did receive him back. And what happens in this story is that Isaac becomes an early parable of the reality of God to bring back people from the dead, or those on the brink of death, that God is able to save from death. And this is an early note about the idea that if God created the world, then God can do anything, including raise from the dead. And so this idea of the resurrection of the dead, Abraham believed that. He had faith. He had trust in the face of invisibility. Even if I offer up my own son in obedience to God, God is able to raise him from the dead and carry on the promises that he has given to me. He's promised this, but I do not see the reality of those promises. I have to trust in the face of invisibility. And here's our first fill in the blank. For Abraham, his experience of faith, his trust in the face of invisibility, is that Abraham is willing to give anything. The first thing about what an experience of faith might look like is a willingness to give anything to God. And that, look, Abraham's story is an amazing story of faith. And maybe, look, I don't think you're going to be called to take a knife to your own children. You're never going to hear that from here. That's like a cult, okay? But anyway, but all that to say, like, you know, we're, okay, all right, let's rope it in, Pastor Craig. But maybe you have given up something for God, something that you really wanted, that you really felt like you needed, something that you had in your life that you were called to give up. Maybe not as severe as sacrificing your own child, but perhaps you've metaphorically had to offer up a family member waiting for God to bring them back from the dead, so to speak. They've wandered away and you're waiting for God to offer that resurrection. Maybe you've had to cut something out of your life for your faithfulness to God or even something dear to you. And that is, as you reflect on your life of trust in the face of invisibility, as you reflect on that, that's a profound part of your story of faith. I think even in this, Abraham is called, is a father of faith in many ways, and certainly a great example of that, willing to give up anything. Think about willing to give up everything. He left his family. But it's also true that even a profound experience of faith is simply being willing to give up something. And I would just say, as we think about our own lives, that there might be times when God calls us not to give up everything. I mean, obviously, a call to faith is a willingness for God to do anything in our lives. But there's most of the time what happens is that God might call us to give up something. Maybe not everything, maybe not anything, but a willingness to yield to God in some way. That's one example of an experience of faith with Abraham. Let's keep going on and look at Isaac. Isaac's experience of faith, look at verse 20. By faith, Isaac invoked future blessings on Jacob and Esau. It's a very short verse. Isaac's experience of faith is a little bit, Isaac has two recorded profound experiences of faith. One happens early in his life and one happens late in his life, according to the book of Genesis. The first was when he was 12, 13 years old. He allows his 100-year-old father to tie him up on an altar. That's a lot of trust, right? He waits for God to stay Abraham's hand. And at the end of his life, what the book of Hebrews records is that Isaac will bless, and it's an act of faith that he blesses Jacob and Esau. But in between, Isaac's life is a bit of a puzzle as it comes to faith. The only son of promise to Abraham, you might expect profound faith out of Isaac, profound trust in the face of invisibility. But the only thing we really know about Isaac is, one, that he repeats many of the errors of his father Abraham. Don't try that at home. And the second thing is that he really likes barbecue. I mean, that's what we know about this guy, about Isaac. We don't know a lot about Isaac. We know that he has twin sons by Rebekah, Jacob and Esau. Esau is older, Jacob is younger. And at one point in the story, God makes it clear that even though Esau is older and Jacob is younger, and traditionally it would be the older one that would be blessed, God makes it clear that the older will serve the younger, that it will actually be Jacob who will be blessed and not Esau. But here's the thing. Isaac really likes Esau because Esau's a hunter and he's able to bring home the food and he likes meat. I mean, it's like Esau's like hairy and a hunter and Isaac likes barbecue. It's like a men's ministry parable, right? And but here's the thing. God says, look, it's going to be Jacob that you're going to bless. So when Isaac is on his deathbed, what does he do? Does he say, Jacob, come here? No, he's like, Esau, give me one last great meal. He's getting ready to bless Esau. He knows that God had promised and commanded that it's going to be through Jacob, but he's like, nope, I'm going to do it my way. And Isaac is like, I'm going to bless Esau. But Rebekah and Jacob, and this is, again, this is Old Testament narratives are descriptive, not prescriptive, everybody. This is not a church ministry program that's going on here with Rebekah and Jacob. They fool Isaac. They dress Jacob up in like hairy clothes. It's so weird to think, I mean, how hairy was this guy? They dress him up in like hairy clothes, and they fool their blind father into blessing Jacob. Now here's the profound act of faith, is that Isaac at the end, when he realizes that he's been tricked, and he realizes that he has not blessed Esau, he has blessed Jacob. This is the act of faith. He does not go back and reverse it. He finally, and here's your fill in the blank, he finally comes to grips with the plans of God. He finally yields to God. Now, here's the thing. Like, as a pastor, I'm like, That's a story of faith. I don't know if I want to disciple that story of faith. Like, I wouldn't say to everybody, hey, wait till your deathbed to yield to the plans of God. That's not what I would say, right? I would say, look, walk in obedience now. It won't be as painful later. But the truth is, it is an experience of faith to be celebrated. If somebody at the end finally comes to grips with the plan of God, that's not just like, hey, you just made it in by the skin of your teeth. That's something to be celebrated. There was still a softness to Isaac. Through the hunting and the hairiness and the barbecue and all that stuff, he finally realizes it's not really about my tastes. It's about what God has promised and planned. It might be invisible to me, but I will trust in the face of invisibility. And maybe that's something even at your point in your life right now, you might be at the point where you're saying, yeah, I feel like I've come to grips with what God has before me. I might fight it, I might not like it, but I've come to grips and I'm going to walk in that. I realize where I'm at right now. Isaac's a good example that it's never too late to come to grips with God's plan. God can change a heart, even if it is painful in the end. So that's Abraham. Abraham's willing to give anything. Isaac has come to grips with God's plan. Those are both examples of experiences of faith. Trust in the face of invisibility. What about Jacob? Jacob, our Hebrews moves to the end of Jacob's complex story of faith. Jacob has a long story of faith in the book of Genesis. Hebrews only really talks about the end. 11:21. By faith, Jacob, when dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph, bowing in worship over the head of his staff. Now, just like Isaac was a complicated story of faith, Jacob is also a complicated story of faith, full of running and sojourning in a foreign land and deception and trickery, but eventually having a profound experience of faith that sets a trajectory in his life that he will have a family that will become known as the nation of Israel. Jacob's name will start as Jacob, but it will end as Israel, one who strives with God. So here's the story. Jacob, after he tricks his father to get the family blessing, he has a very angry brother who's good at hunting. Right? So what does Jacob do? Like, Esau is angry. He's on the war path. He's going to get his bow and arrow, right? Jacob's gone. He leaves. He takes off. Jacob runs. He eventually marries. He has a family, which God blesses. But the day comes decades later when he has to go back to his homeland, back to his brother Esau, who the last time he saw him wanted to kill him. And he has to go back. And Jacob has this really interesting strategy. What he does, as God has blessed him with all these possessions, all these servants, all these family members, he sends all these possessions over to Esau early. And then he sends his family over to Esau. And he's the last one. And the last night before he visits Esau, he's alone. And some way or another, a man or an angel, or if it's God, shows up and he wrestles with him. All night, he wrestles with him. It's a little bit of this idea that, and the traditions about Jacob is that he has great strength. And part of this is that he wrestles with this angel, and in the process of that, the angel, in order to defeat Jacob, touches his hip. He puts his hip out of joint. I mean, it's like an MMA match, right? Where it's like he wants to tap out, but he just dislocates his hip. And Jacob, even though his hip is dislocated, it says that Jacob holds on to him and says, "Bless me, bless me." So similar to even Esau, when Esau comes to his father after being cheated out of his blessing and says, "Bless me too, bless me too." Jacob finds himself on the verge of meeting Esau, and he's like, "Bless me, bless me." And the angel says, "Okay, let go of me, and I will bless you." And he does. I think Jacob in many ways wanted to dictate terms with God, and God says, "Okay, we can do that, but you're going to walk with a limp." The angel disables Jacob. Jacob hangs on until morning but is blessed by God, but he comes out of this encounter with God. He names the place where he wrestles with the angel Peniel, which means the face of God, because he feels like he has encountered God face to face in this wrestling match. He's encountered God, but it has disabled him for his life. He will not be the same. Now, at the end of his life, after having all these children, reconciling with his brother Esau, Jacob goes down to Egypt because of a famine, where one of his sons that he thought was dead has actually been spared and risen to power in Egypt, and his name is Joseph. That's the next one. But in 11:21, this is what it says of Jacob. Jacob, when dying at the end of his life, he blessed each of the sons of Joseph. And then it has this last phrase, bowing in worship over the head of his staff. And it's a little bit of a puzzling, why is that information included? Bowing in worship over the head of his staff. Maybe a better translation of that and meaning gets at that Jacob worships while leaning on his staff. And what it reminds us is that Jacob, with a staff, has been a traveler like his father Abraham, who had to trust in the face of invisibility. He's been a traveler, but he's a traveler who has to lean on his staff because he has been injured in his encounter with God. But even while leaning on his staff, what does he do? He worships the God who wounded him. And that's what we have, that's your next fill in the blank, is that he worships the God who wounded him. He worships even though he has to lean on this staff as a limping traveler for the rest of his life. The one who has made him travel, the one who has made him limp, is his God. And he knows of nothing else that he can do with this God except to ask for his blessing and to worship him, even the God who has wounded him. It's a profound act of faith, trust in the face of invisibility, to take the wounds of our lives, even the wounds that we might feel have been inflicted by God, and continue to trust and worship. Sometimes that is the experience of faith that God calls us to. And so with Abraham, he's willing to give anything. With Isaac, he finally comes to grips with God's plan. And Jacob worships the God who wounded him. And Joseph, as we come to Joseph here, the fourth generation of this family of faith. What an interesting, dysfunctional, weird family this is. You're like, I feel right at home at church if that's the family, right? I know, because I've got a crazy uncle too. Maybe you are the crazy uncle in your family, right? But the idea is that this quirky, dysfunctional, even sinful family, again, it's descriptive, not prescriptive. And there's a lot of things that these guys do that are not recommended, that break the Ten Commandments, et cetera, et cetera. But there is still a place of faith. One thing that this family does do that we recognize with Joseph, one thing that they do well, and one thing that is an act of faith, they tell the stories of the promises of God. You're like, well, Craig, I can't see that in here, but let me make the case here. We don't always hear it in the narratives of Genesis, but when we get to the story of Joseph, in Hebrews 11:22, it says, by faith Joseph, at the end of his life, made mention of the exodus of the Israelites and gave directions concerning his bones. Now you're like, all right, now if you're going to make something of this, go ahead, Pastor Craig. There's nothing in there. Okay, hang on. Now it says he makes mention of the exodus. That's Israel's exodus, means the way out, the road out. And Exodus is the second book of the Bible. It talks about the nation of Israel exiting, their exodus out of Egypt into the promised land. The word in Hebrews is that it says that he makes mention of the Exodus. That's not the word that is in there. The word in there is that he remembers the Exodus. Now, here's the thing. In Joseph's day, the Exodus will not happen for 400 years. The Exodus is in the future. So the question is, how is it that Joseph remembers the Exodus that has not yet happened? The story of Joseph is in Genesis chapter 50. But if you go back, before Jacob, you go back before Isaac, and you go back to Genesis 15 with Abraham, one of the promises that God gives to Abraham is that your descendants, this innumerable amount of the sand of the seashore, the stars of the sky, they will find themselves in a foreign land, and God will rescue them out of that foreign land. That they'll be in there for 400 years, God will rescue them out. Now that is, Abraham is Joseph's great-grandfather. Back in Genesis 15, God is making that promise and that prediction. And now Joseph is in Egypt, and he's remembering something that has never happened. The only way he knows about it is because his crazy great-grandfather must have told that story to his barbecue-loving son, who told that story to his lying, cheating dad, who told that story to a son that he thought was dead, who God restored. And he must have, even Joseph, when his brothers beat him up and sold him into slavery, and he was serving as a slave in Egypt, he must have remembered that story. And then when he got falsely accused and thrown into prison, he must have remembered that story. And then when God vindicated him and brought him into a position of power, he must have remembered that story. And at the end of his life, he said, hey, when we make it out of here, because we will make it out of here, you remember to take my bones and gather my bones to my fathers, because God is faithful. He will deliver. My great-grandfather, he knew it. He didn't see it, but he trusted in the face of invisibility. And he was not a perfect man, but he told the story to his son, who was not a perfect man, but he told the story to his son, who was not a perfect man, who told that story to me. And I am not a perfect man, but I know that our God is faithful. And we can trust in the face of invisibility. I don't know what your story is. I love the Jacob story is awesome because in our congregation, we have a lot of grandparents and a lot of great-grandparents in here. We got a lot of grandparents. I love the Jacob story because it says, by faith, he blessed the sons of Joseph. I don't know if there's a better grandfather or grandmother moment than when you bless your grandchildren. right? When he, as he leans on his staff and worships, he blesses his grandchildren, the sons of Joseph. And the idea that we can somehow pass along faith, and maybe faith was not passed along to us. Maybe you're the first in your generation, in your family, that has come to a profound faith in Jesus. And maybe you're the starting point of telling that story and starting a new movement. Or maybe you're receiving something that's beautiful and long held. Certainly your parents and grandparents were not perfect, but they've told the stories and they've passed it along. And maybe you're simply in a position where now it's your spot in the chain of faith, of a long lineage of faith, and maybe now you're just able to say, okay, I will trust in the face of invisibility. You think about all these people, the stories and what they had to endure and what their faith might have looked like. It was not exactly the same generation to generation. And now here we are, we sit in a spot where we have a unique story of faith to now pass along to our own children and to lean into as followers of Jesus. And so this morning, I just wonder if as we, I'm going to invite the worship team to come on up. But just as they come up, if we could just reflect for a moment, if you had a one line of a moment of faith or a profound experience of faith in your life, what it might look like, willing to give anything. What a wonderful story of faith. Coming to grips with God's plan. What a wonderful story of faith. Even if you're late to the party, I always say, I might be late to the party, but I'm earnest when I get there, right? Maybe that's your story too. That's okay. That's a story of faith. Maybe you are worshiping the God who has wounded you and you're dealing with that. You're trying to come to grips with God's activity in your life that has been so difficult to come to grips with. Or maybe like Joseph, you are remembering the stories and promises. What would a good one-sentence phrase about a formative experience of faith be for you? Maybe one of these really resonates with you this morning. That's wonderful. We would imagine that God's Holy Spirit works in our, as we respond, as we think about what God is doing, that in this room, that God is working in different ways. But just to think and reflect, even this next week, just to think and reflect, even for your family, to put it before your family and ask, what do you guys think would be a good, what is God doing in our life? I think for me, stepping into a call of learning the Word of God and serving the church of God. That's not been an easy path. Like, that's a weird path for me. It seems like it was not what I expected it might look like. But I do feel like coming to grips with this idea. In my larger family lineage, I think it would be about deepening a faith that maybe was already there, but deepening it in my family and helping my family come along on that journey. Orienting my marriage and my family and my work around the supremacy of Jesus. Just think about what might that look like for you? What would be a one-sentence description about your experience of faith?